So today we're kicking off the sign up for our life groups. Life groups are a beautiful way in which our church comes together in small groups at different times and different places throughout our city and encourages one another, shares life together, shares a pretty good meal, talks about life and faith. And it's one of my favorite times of the week. And so we have sign up sheets back here in the back, and I just want to encourage you over the course of the next few weeks to go by and to sign up. If you have been a part of a life group and you want to stay in that life group, go ahead and just sign your name there. If you want to think about a different life group, that is okay. It is allowed. You're welcome to sign up on any of the others, or just says, I've never been a part of a life group, or I'd like to kind of change life groups. And there's a sheet for that as well. Also, if you are interested in becoming a life group leader and learning what that is like, how to host one, what that might look like, different ways that might take place, there's also a sheet for that, or come and talk to me or Roy, and we'd be happy to teach you how to do that. Over the course of the next few weeks, we'll also be talking to people in life groups and just seeing about the impact it makes on their life and on their faith and how it is drawing them closer to God and deepening their relationships with other people. So I'm excited for that, and that's all going to kick off. Life groups will kick off on September 9th. We're continuing our series as we talk about the meaning of discipleship. What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus, and how does that then play out in our lives? Last week, Roy confessed to being a boat rocker. He says he kind of likes to shake things up and make people at times even feel uncomfortable. I am completely the opposite. As opposite can be. I've always been pretty even-keeled, go with the flow. That's who I am. And I have always liked to be liked. I don't like people to not like me, to have any sort of conflict with me. As I was growing up, I was quiet, reserved, not easy to fluster. In fact, I tried to keep conflict to a minimum. And so the scripture that Paul just read for us would fill me with dread. Go and confront someone about things that might be happening in their life, because whatever you bind and loose is bound and loosed. And learn how to practice forgiveness. Because I am a guy who doesn't like conflict, except with my family. Because there's nobody quite like family who knows how to push your buttons, isn't there? Those are the people who know exactly what things to say and or do to drive you absolutely up the wall. I was talking to somebody this weekend, and they were just talking about how difficult life was with their 14, now 15-year-old, and how they had hated that last year of parenting. No offense to the kids in the room, that happens, all right? And I just commiserated, and I said, yeah, at 14, I was grounded the whole year. Every time I'd come off a grounding, I would go right back on because I was a smart aleck and I knew exactly how to push my mom's buttons. And that was especially true, not just for my mom, but for my brother, Peter. Peter is quiet to the extreme. He is easygoing and he makes me look like I like conflict. But that's only true to a point. And so as I was growing up, I would pick on him a lot. I was good at it because he would take it. He wouldn't say a word. So I would tease him, I would pester him, I'd pick on him, I'd annoy him. I knew exactly what that line in the sand was that I couldn't cross, but man, I would get right up to it. Say anything and do anything to drive him crazy. And so I would push it right up to that point. Now, before you start to feel too sorry for my brother Peter, he could do the same thing to me. He knows exactly where those buttons are. And for the longest time, I had the upper hand until I went away to college. And my freshman year of college, my little brother grew 3 inches, put on about 25 pounds of muscle, and joined the high school wrestling team. And so at Christmas, I came home and I began to pick on him, and I wound up with my face shoved down in the carpet, begging for mercy, because there was no way I was going to get out of that. He got me back at that moment for all of those times growing up, so don't feel too bad for him. But when we would fight as kids, our parents would give us this time to then cool off because we needed it. And they would have us come back and apologize and shake hands. And you know how well that goes when that's forced, right? But my dad would always look at us and he would tell us, no matter what, you will always be brothers. So you better learn to get along now. Which is easier said than done when you're like 7 and 10, right? Because forgiveness can be hard, can't it? To learn how to let something go when you have the right to hold it against them, when something's been said or done to you, that is easier to hold on to and to let fester inside than to let go, right? And that's especially true with those who are closest to us, a friend who betrays our trust, a family member who hurts us or our feelings, a spouse who says something snotty, a close classmate who makes us feel belittled, a coworker who gossips behind our back. It's easy to say, forgive, but it's difficult to do. In fact, the closer the relationship, the more that seems lost when that hurt happens and forgiveness is needed, which lays behind the question that we had this morning. Lord, how many times should I forgive my brother or sister who sins against me? Up to 7 times. And Peter has come to Jesus, and this is his question. You can always count on Peter to ask the questions on everybody else's mind. How much is enough? Quantify it for me. Give me a number I can count. How often should I forgive? I want you to think for a minute. How many of you know this statement? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Which tells us that twice is our limit, right? I might forgive you once for hurting my feelings, but if we go beyond that, that's the point. That's the line in the sand. I am done with you. In fact, we should have never gotten here in the first place. Rabbis in Jesus' day were teaching that forgiveness ought to be extended 3 times. In fact, it's part of the Talmud, the teaching of the day, that said that forgiveness was to be extended 3 times to any individual who asked for it. So really here, Peter is being quite generous in his question. I mean, he's more than doubling the estimates that are out there. And 7 is a good perfect number in the Bible, and it's holy, so let's go with that one, Peter seems to say. That seems like an abundance of grace, doesn't it? But Jesus' response makes Peter seem rather paltry. And Jesus answered, I tell you, not 7 times, but 77 times. And that expression could also mean 70 times 7 or 490, but it's less important to think about the number than the idea. Jesus says, you should forgive without measure. You should offer people outlandish grace. And then Jesus tells a story to emphasize his point. There once was a king, Jesus says, who did things that would seem rather unkingly to us. He went out and he loaned money to his servants. And one of them somehow had taken great advantage of this king's generosity, because he had borrowed extravagantly, recklessly. And we don't know why. Maybe he had this once-in-a-lifetime idea. If I just had a little starting capital, I could get this off the ground. Maybe he had this just great business plan in mind. He thought, if I just do this, it's all going to work out. Maybe he just kept failing at everything he tried. And so he kept borrowing more money to cut his losses rather than cutting his losses. We don't know how he got here, and nor does it really matter. But the amount he has borrowed is extreme. He's not just upside down in his finances. He is underwater. He is drowning in debt. You see, the average day laborer made 1 denarii a day. That's about 1 silver coin. And they would work for 6 days a week as Jewish people, because you take the Sabbath off, and then you had 2 weeks of festivals, so that's 50 weeks a year. And at that rate, 1 talent of money would take you about 20 years to accrue. And this guy had borrowed 10,000 talents from the king. He had borrowed so much that it would approximately take him 200,000 years to pay back what he owed with no interest at all. And this guy, the text tells us, was just unable to pay. Man, is that an understatement of the text, right? This guy had enough debt to bankrupt countries, not just an individual. His life was forfeit. And so he does the only thing that he could possibly do. He begs. He falls to his knees and he pleads, be patient with me. and I will pay back everything. Which is a lie, because where is he going to get that kind of money? But he is at his wit's end, and this is all he can think of to do. And our king does something audacious. No, he does something that's insane. It makes no sense financially, practically, but he does it anyway. It tells us the king has compassion on this man. And he doesn't just postpone the payments or come up with a payment plan. He just cancels the debt outright. He takes the receipt, he rips it up, and it is all done away with. There's no bankruptcy, no wage garnishment, no foreclosures. The king simply wipes it all away and gives him a clean slate. And at that, this servant should be the most grace-filled person on the planet. He should be dancing for joy and singing the king's praises at the top of his lungs, telling everybody he meets about this moment. He shouldn't be able to keep quiet about how good this king is. Megan loves listening to the Dave Ramsey show and podcast. To me, it seems like the same thing for 3 hours every day, but it is a great series of stories, and thankful it exists, right? Almost every episode at some point has an individual or a family who comes on, and they talk the exact same story. They talk about how much debt they had and how they got there and how following this plan then helped them to get out of debt slowly or quickly. Every story is different, but they always end the same way. Dave Ramsey has them scream out at the end, "We're debt free," and then they ring cowbells and do explosions, and it's lots of fun, right? Because they are excited that this weight that was on their back is finally gone. And here's a man who should be screaming at the top of his lungs. This should be that watershed moment of his life, the time he looks back and says, "Everything changed that day on the floor when I begged and the king had compassion." Nothing should ever be the same. And instead, what we find is this man becomes, well, just shows that he is still mean and petty and selfish, arrogant and hostile, that he is violent and filled with rage and malice. Because as he leaves from there, he runs into another servant who owes him a little bit of money. And it's not a small amount, but it wasn't anything compared to what he had owed before. And rather than having compassion, well, no, he throttles him. He chokes him. He threatens him, and then he has him thrown in prison to repay that small debt. He shows his hatred and his spite. This was a man who had been forgiven, but couldn't find it in his heart to forgive. And why? Well, because he felt wrong. He felt wronged. That this man had sinned against him. For him, it was personal now. And he wanted what was his. He wanted justice. You see, we often want mercy for ourselves, but justice for anybody else who has hurt us. And it's easier for us to accept grace than it is to extend it to others. Now, this is a story Jesus tells about money, but it really has absolutely nothing to do with money. Instead, it's a story about sin. The king, God, gives grace to the one who doesn't deserve it. Why? Because that debt, our sin, is seemingly impossible, and there's no way that we can get rid of it. We got ourselves into it, and we don't know how, and we don't know why, nor does it matter, but it is so overwhelming, and we are so underwater that there is nothing that could ever be done to free us. But as massive as our sin is, it pales in comparison to the greatness of God's grace, to the overwhelming compassion of God that is so much greater than our sin. And all we have to do is ask, and it will be taken away. God wipes it all clean. The slate is made clean, and that forgiveness is freely given. Because Jesus wants us to know from this story that forgiveness and compassion is part of the very nature and character of God himself. You see, there's a story right before this that Roy touched on last week in Matthew 18 that talks about how God is like a shepherd with 100 sheep, and he cares so much for that one lost sheep that he left the 99 to chase after the one because he loved it that much. His compassion was so great for the one that was lost that he left everything else. Because God is a God of grace and compassion. He gives grace to those who don't deserve it, and forgiveness to all those who desire. But it also comes with an expectation. The one who has received great grace is meant to extend great grace generously and graciously to other people. We are called to give grace because we have been given grace. We forgive because we have been forgiven. Indeed, forgiveness is one of the major themes we find as we flip through the Gospel of Matthew. I want you to think back to the Sermon on the Mount as Jesus stops and he teaches them how to pray. And it goes like this: Our Father in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us today our daily bread and forgive us our debts as we also have forgiven our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. And entire books can be written on this prayer as you take each little phrase and part and parse out what it means. But as Jesus tells us how to pray, he only focuses on the one. For if you forgive other people when they sin against you, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you don't forgive others their sins, your Father also will not forgive yours. As Jesus thinks about everything that has just hit them in the sermon before this and on the prayer he has just taught them how to pray, this is what he chooses to emphasize. Also in the sermon, Jesus has told them that reconciliation is more important than anything else, including religious sacrifice. If you have gone all the way to Jerusalem from wherever you live, and you have gone through all of the prayers and cleansings that you have to do as you move towards the temple, and you have paid for your sacrifice or led it all the way from home, and you have grabbed a priest and you've pulled them off to the side, and you are getting ready to go through the sacrifice, you have put in time and effort and money, and as you're doing that, you realize that you're upset at somebody or somebody else is upset at you, then Jesus says, go home and fix that first. Because God desires mercy more than sacrifice. God wants reconciliation. That becomes your offering to him. And then come back and continue the worship you've been doing. For God, that act of reconciliation is their act of worship. For those of us who have experienced forgiveness, we're called to extend forgiveness to other people. So what is forgiveness? Because we often speak too flippantly about the idea. In English, we have the phrase forgive and forget, like you could ever possibly do that short of traumatic brain injury, right? And we tell people you should just let bygones be bygones, forgive, and then just move on, right? But forgiveness doesn't always actually mean reconciliation. Let me say, if you have suffered traumatic abuse, physical or emotional or psychological or other, that's not something that can be forgotten. And forgiving doesn't mean you necessarily try to fix that relationship. In fact, you probably shouldn't. So it's got to mean something more than that. In their book, The Book of Forgiving, a good title, Desmond Tutu and his daughter, Mfoe Tutu, write about the fourfold path of practicing forgiveness. And for them, they say that means you tell the story of whatever's happened to you. Then you name the hurt. You grant forgiveness and you renew or you release the relationship. And there are people who can speak to forgiveness for the things that they had to suffer. But they describe forgiveness as the best form of self-interest. They say forgiveness is not just seeking to ignore the hatred or anger that you might feel at the actions of another person. It's not trying to sweep it all under the rug or pretend that it didn't exist. Instead, they state, when I talk of forgiveness, I mean the belief that you can come out the other side a better person. A better person than the one who is being consumed by anger and hatred. Remaining in that state locks you in a state of victimhood, making you almost dependent on the perpetrator. If you can find it in yourself to forgive, then you're no longer chained to the one who hurt you. You can move on and even help the perpetrator become a better person too. Forgiving means that we are reclaiming the event and re-narrating it in our lives. We are taking back and healing our lives so that we can truly live. In her book, Rising Strong, Brené Brown argues that for forgiveness to happen, something has to die. Now, that's not saying go hunt down the perpetrator, right? But she says, if you make a choice to forgive, you have to face into the pain. Something has to die. That might mean putting to death the ideal of what could have or should have been had that event not occurred. You're just going to have to say, that is never going to be the way that it is, but we can find a new normal. It might be we have to put to death the idea that you can make everything all right or heal the relationship with your words or your effort. It might be just realizing we have to kill the idea of the power that comes with being right. You have to kill it kill your need for the notion for vengeance and sublime justice of seeing what the person get what's coming to them, because you might not get to see that. Or it might be putting aside the right to be hurt and offended by what has happened. Because forgiveness is more about us and where we are and where we're finding our strength to move forward than it necessarily is about the other. But it's interesting because we are also too flippant in saying something can't be forgiven too. Mary Johnson lost her son in 1993 when O'Shea Israel at a party got in a fight with him and then shot him and killed him. And for 12 years, Ms. Johnson held hate for this man. And she prayed that he would get what was coming to him. She hoped that terrible things would take place in his life. But about 12 years into the man's stay, she went to visit him in prison. He had committed this act at 16. He was now 28. And life had not been easy. But as she sat and began to talk with him, she says, I began to feel this movement in my feet. It moved up my legs and it just moved up my body. And when I felt it leave me, I instantly knew that all the anger and hatred and animosity I had in my heart for you for 12 years was over. And in the course of this conversation, I have learned to forgive you. And when O'Shea got out of prison, he moved into the same apartment complex. And she began to cook him dinner and invite her into her home. And she said, you are going to make something of your life. And so she helped him get his GED and helped him go to college and sat there as he graduated. She began to call him her spiritual son. Miss Johnson got married 3 years ago. The man on the far right of the picture is O'Shea Israel, her spiritual son who shot her son, who is now a part of her life that she loves. That is him, by the way, in this picture as well. That's forgiveness. She had every right to carry that grudge in her heart. But she showed him love instead. In our story, our king offers unmerited forgiveness. He wipes away an enormous debt because of his own compassionate character, because that's who he is. And he doesn't bring any judgment into that discussion until he discovers that the grace hadn't changed the heart of the one who had received it in the first place. Because from those who have been forgiven much, forgiveness becomes our responsibility. Because we know that we are sinful and our sin has separated us from God, but we also realize that our sin has been forgiven because of God's great compassion and love, and we are called to forgive as we have been forgiven. And as followers of Jesus, the one who is friends with sinners and extends forgiveness to those in need, the one who offers grace to all regardless, we know grace and forgiveness, and so we're called to extend it to other people because in doing so, we display the heart and character of God himself. We're about to enter into a time of worship and then leading towards our communion. And I want to challenge you as we sing, as we worship, as we approach God's table to look at your heart and your life. I'm going to ask our elders, I didn't run this by them, I'm going to ask them if they would just go to the lobby in the back. They're looking at me stone-faced at the moment. I'm going to ask them if they would be there. I'm going to go back there as well. But if at this moment you have a burden on your heart that you feel is weighing you down, or you have somebody in your life you have found it difficult to forgive, or you have done something that needs to be forgiven and you're not certain it can ever be made right, I want to challenge you to spend some time in prayer. And if you need to, come back and talk to somebody today. Because we are told before we go to the altar, we have to examine ourselves. And if there's anything we need to learn to lay it aside as our act of worship before we move on. So we're going to offer this time and space. If you need it, if you need to respond, if God is prompting you somehow, I pray that you will do that. But may God bless us as we worship, as we commune, and as we encourage one another. Let's sing together.